for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software. Information on the web at mathworks.com.
From WBUR in Boston, it's Here and Now. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Gail Harris. Coming up, a congressional report says the U.S. Justice Department did not follow up on a request from the IRS to investigate Enron back in 1999.
The Pentagon shelves a controversial betting plan that was supposed to predict terrorist behavior.
Tough laws can prevent the sale of cigarettes to teenagers, but guess what? A study says they'll smoke anyway.
Now, if the goal is to reduce adolescent smoking, this is not doing it. And I think we probably would be better directed to raise the price of cigarettes.
Also, Ariel Sharon visits the White House.
As does the Saudi foreign minister.
And we take a trip to Coney Island. These stories and more, coming up here and now.
The news is first.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Carol Van Dam. The White House has rejected a request by the Saudi Arabian government to declassify even more portions of a congressional report on the 9/11 hijackings put out by Congress last week. NPR's Don Gagne reports from the White House.
All but 28 pages of the 900-page report have been made public. The Saudis' position is that there are allegations of possible links between their government and some of the 9/11 hijackers, and they maintain they can't defend themselves against such accusations unless they can see what is in the blacked-out portions of the report. This afternoon, the Saudi foreign minister will meet with President Bush to formally make the request for more pages to be declassified. But the White House, in advance of that meeting, has already said no. Press Secretary Scott McClellan says that to do what the Saudis are asking would jeopardize ongoing investigations into the 9/11 attacks, and it could hurt national security, he says, by compromising sensitive sources. Don Gagne, NPR News, the White House.
Airlines and law enforcement agencies have been warned by the Department of Homeland Security to be on the lookout for operatives of al-Qaeda who may try to carry out new suicide hijackings within the next few months. An intelligence source says the warning came from intercepted communications and from information received from at least one member of al-Qaeda imprisoned by American authorities. Efforts to pass a compromise budget to deal with California's record $38 billion deficit have stalled in the state assembly. We get more from NPR's Richard Gonzalez.
The California budget plan is a mixed bag of social spending cuts and heavy borrowing. It rolls over $8 billion of debt into next fiscal year, and it includes no new taxes, a condition Republicans insisted upon for their support. The compromise plan sailed through the Senate on Sunday, but early Tuesday morning it failed to win the necessary two-thirds majority in the Assembly. Speaker Herb Wesson then locked the Assembly chambers as he began negotiations to get more Republican support.
We have a job to do. It would be irresponsible for us to send people home without doing our job.
The delay in passing a budget is bad news for Governor Gray Davis. His popularity dropped as the budget impasse dragged on, fueling the move to recall him. Davis has indicated that he will sign the budget plan as soon as possible. Richard Gonzalez, NPR News, Sacramento.
President Bush is meeting with Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon at the White House today, 4 days after meeting with Palestinian Prime Minister Mahmoud Abbas. Sharon has agreed to remove some West Bank checkpoints and free more than 500 jailed Palestinians. U.S. military officials say a total of 12 Iraqis were arrested in a series of pre-dawn raids carried out in Saddam Hussein's hometown today. One of Saddam's longtime bodyguards was arrested, as well as the former chief of security in the city of Tikrit. On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow Industrials are down 22 points to 92.43. The Nasdaq is down 5. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, consumers' overall confidence in the economy fell this month to its lowest level since March, according to a report by Business Industry Group. The Consumer Confidence Index fell 7 points from June to July. Analysts had expected the index to rise a point and a half. An analyst with the board says the sharp drop is primarily due to the continued weakness in the job market. The monthly index is a sampling of 5,000 U.S. households. The Recording Industry Association of America has named a new chairman and CEO. The move comes at a time when the lobbying group that represents the major record labels is aggressively fighting unauthorized file sharing on the Internet. NPR's Nita Ulibi reports. Mitch Bainwall replaces Hillary Rosen, who led the RIAA for the past 5 years. She steered the association through a period during which the RIAA began its intensive campaign against the file sharing of copyrighted music online. The association successfully sued to close Napster. As a result, the RIAA head must face strong feelings from people both inside and outside the music industry over issues of property rights. Bainwall brings strong Capitol Hill connections to the lobbying job. While his predecessor is a Democrat, Bainwall is the former chief of staff to U.S. Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist. Mitch Bainwall said in a statement released yesterday that he was delighted to take the position. Netta Ulibi, NPR News, Washington.
Japanese auto production is up for the first time in 4 months. The hike is largely due to a demand for new models at home and abroad. The Japan Automobile Manufacturers Association says auto production in Japan rose 3.9% last month. I'm Carol Van Dam, NPR News in Washington.
The NPR Shop introduces All Songs Considered 3, the newest compilation of music heard on All Things Considered at npr.org.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Gail Harrison for Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Although the Enron Corporation has gone belly up, the company's financial doings are continuing to come under intense scrutiny. After a year-and-a-half investigation, two banks, Citigroup and J.P. Morgan, will pay a total of $305 million in fines, although the banks say they did nothing wrong. SEC officials say the banks helped Enron deceive investors by hiding billions of dollars in loans. Also today, a separate investigative report by the Senate Finance Committee accuses Enron of conducting illegal practices in Guatemala throughout the 90s. James Grimaldi writes about this latest chapter in Enron's history in today's Washington Post. Hi, James.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thanks. So tell us, what exactly did the Senate Finance Committee find?
Well, they found that in 1999, an inspector from the Internal Revenue Service had referred to the Justice Department possible violations of the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act regarding certain payments to an intermediary of Guatemalan President Jorge Serrano.
And evidently there was evidence that senior Enron officials knew all about this?
Right. The committee determined Enron officials were aware of the payments and their questionable legality. And what happened was, actually, in 1995, a whistleblower from Enron walked into the offices of the Internal Revenue Service in Houston and supplied them with four memos. These memos outlined these payments, which basically were a 6% gross off of the revenues that Enron was going to make for this power plant that was being built in Guatemala as part of their privatization plan. And these memos were enough to prompt an IRS inspector a couple years later to send over a referral to the Justice Department for possible investigation as bribes.
But it took 3 years for even that part to happen? Why so long?
Well, it's not entirely clear. I will say, having read the 500-page Senate Finance Committee report, that it was, like many Enron transactions, a very complicated financial deal.
And James, you also write that in May of 1999, a letter went to Janet Reno, then the Attorney General, and that alerted her to the fact that Enron may have violated the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. So why didn't the Justice Department get involved at that point?
Well, that's the question the Senate Finance Committee has for the Justice Department even today. It's really entirely unclear about what exactly happened and whether the U.S. Attorney's Office in Houston further investigated. But it is known that nothing was done regarding this referral, that the IRS felt confident enough about the facts to at least refer to the Justice Department.
Mm. And how common is it for American companies to pay bribes overseas?
Well, it's a good question, but it is against the law. Even if it is common, that doesn't make it legal. I think this is an area of great interest, even for me as an investigative reporter, because I think very rarely do these things come to light. And I honestly think that this one wouldn't have ever come forward or seen the light of day if Enron had not collapsed from its other accounting irregularities and the Senate Finance Committee hadn't gone down to Houston and unearthed this dormant investigation.
Hmm. And what do you make of the news about Citigroup and J.P. Morgan paying $305 million in fines for, quote, helping commit a fraud, unquote, on Enron shareholders?
Well, it just goes to show that the Enron case will continue to go on. A lot of us are probably past it and have written it off as an episode of corporate corruption in our history. But I think the investigations have months, if not years, to go.
Thank you so much, James, for telling us about this one and for your reporting on it.
Thanks for inviting me.
James Grimaldi is an investigative reporter for The Washington Post. The Bush administration has submitted a plan to Congress that would eliminate Amtrak's unprofitable long-distance routes and put the burden on states to develop shorter-distance travel from city to city. Right now, Amtrak is losing about $1 billion a year, and so far, Congress has only allotted half what the railroad says it needs to maintain existing service next year. One of the long-distance routes that is threatened is the Empire Builder, Amtrak's most popular, although still unprofitable, line that runs between Seattle and Chicago, stopping, among other small towns, in Glasgow, Montana. And joining me on the line is Willie Zeller. He's been the mayor of Glasgow for the last 22 years. Hi, Mr. Mayor.
Hello, Gail.
How big is Glasgow?
Glasgow's about 3,500 people.
And how important is this train to you?
The train is extremely important to the small rural communities along the High Line of northeastern Montana. We don't have bus service up in this part of the state. We have highways and we have cars. It's the only mass transit access we have. Our community is an aging community. We're agricultural based. These older people have a lot of difficulty getting in their car to go to a major medical center. We have a hospital, but it's a small rural hospital, but it's a 600-mile round trip to go to a specialist. It's extremely necessary to have availability of mass transit or the rails to get in and out of here.
Willie, give us a sense, if you will, of how isolated you are.
If you've never been to rural Montana or anywhere in Montana or North Dakota, you have a hard time understanding this. We've got a McDonald's about 6 years ago in the city of Glasgow. If I want to go to a Kmart, I have to drive 160 miles one way. It's about the same distance in the other direction to a Walmart. To go to a Wendy's, it's a 600-mile round trip. We're pretty isolated up here.
How popular is this train? I mean, how difficult is it right now to get a ticket on this train?
A good example of that, Gail, is my wife and her aunt. Want to go visit another aunt in Seattle. They started trying to get a ticket in June. August 5th is the first time they can get a guaranteed reservation to go from Glasgow to Seattle and back to Glasgow. If the train happens to be full coming out of Chicago, we're kind of out of luck along the High Line here. They need more train service, not less train service.
Well, it certainly sounds as if train service is more than just a convenience for you.
It's much more than a convenience. They haul some freight in. It's the only way we can get our forests can get flowers into northeastern Montana. If the train doesn't stop, we have some pretty desolate funerals. The movies, they come in on the train, and they drop them here. Our theater would probably have to either close or put somebody on to drive to Billings and back 600 miles a day to pick up a different movie.
Well, is this something that people in town are really up in arms about? Are they meeting about it, or are they just kind of grumbling to each other about the possibility of losing train service?
The state of Montana Department of Transportation funded a study. Firm out of Washington, D.C. is doing it, a meeting with the Chamber of Commerce and the community leaders about the Amtrak service. The people are fairly upset about it. They're very knowledgeable, and they don't want to lose the service, if at all possible.
Well, we can certainly appreciate that. Willie, thank you so much for joining us, and good luck out there in Big Sky Country.
Come on, visit us. Ride the train.
Okay.
Thank you.
Willie Zeller is the mayor of Glasgow, Montana, and has been for the last 22 years.
There are reports this morning that U.S. intelligence officials are predicting the possibility of new terrorist attacks this summer, similar to the airplane hijackings of 9/11. The information reported in today's Washington Post comes from interviews with high-level al-Qaeda captives and was allegedly corroborated by intercepted emails and other means. Well, meantime, the Pentagon is scrapping its controversial plan that would have allowed investors to bet on terrorist acts, much the way future traders bet on pork bellies, the thinking being the market is as good a predictor as, say, the CIA. But after protests from two senators and media coverage, that plan was scrapped late this morning. Well, joining us now is Josh Meyer, who covers Washington for the LA Times. And Josh, first, let's talk about this new intelligence, these reports of potential suicide airplane hijackings. Do they sound credible to you?
Well, it's that's a good question. I mean, it depends on what you mean by credible. Whether or not people are saying that is one thing, including interrogations with captured al-Qaeda members, and whether or not there's actually anything to it is another matter. We actually held off on writing a story about it today in the LA Times because it just seems like there's so many of these threats out there. In this case, the Homeland Security Department, which is still, you know, getting up and running, said that they're investigating this to see if there's anything to the credibility of the information, that it does come from more than one source, but that it has not been corroborated yet.
Right.
So it's anybody's guess as to, you know, what it means.
And in fact, they alerted the airlines but didn't raise the terrorism threat index, which would seem to be some indicator.
Right.
Well, turning to the other story, the Pentagon announced and then quickly scrapped, actually it was revealed by two senators, a Pentagon plan that was scrapped this morning, that would have allowed investors as early as this Friday to put money into a new kind of futures market that would bet on terrorist attacks. This plan was created with the help of the Economist magazine intelligence unit. We looked on their website, and they list intelligence on 200 countries, and then investors read that intelligence and decide how to invest their money.
Right.
Well, the Defense Department apparently had hoped that these investors would put their money on possible terrorist attacks in the Middle East initially.
Right. Yes. In fact, that was irresistible. We couldn't resist not writing about that one. So we did. I did write a story about that today. And essentially, what they were, the Pentagon through its DARPA, which is its Advanced Research and Planning arm, was going to do was encourage futures traders to buy, invest essentially in the potential for terrorist attacks, the assassination of political leaders, even bio warfare. Attacks on Israel and so forth. The thinking being that if all of these experts in their own fields believe that something's going to happen, that it's sort of a canary in a coal mine and that it might help them predict future terrorist attacks.
Right. Well, some who follow the stock market recently might question the government's faith in its ability. But the other question is, what's to stop a terrorist from investing in an event and then carrying the event out to collect the money?
Well, there's a cloak of anonymity over this, which the government, which the Pentagon said was to protect the investors. But the two senators who cried foul yesterday said that that's one of the problems, that terrorists conceivably could sort of cloak themselves in this kind of anonymity and invest in potential terrorist attacks and then carry them out and actually profit from them. So this morning, several senators, including John Warner, who's head of the Armed Services Committee, if I'm not mistaken, had a rather frank discussion with people at the Pentagon and afterwards said that by mutual consent they've killed the program. We think that it might have been directed more from Congress toward the Pentagon than it being a mutual thing. But as soon as it hit the front page of our paper and I think the New York Times today, I think it was within about an hour or two that they killed the program. So I think it's not going anywhere at this point.
Back to the drawing board on that one.
Yeah.
Well, Josh, thank you.
You're welcome.
Josh Meyer is a reporter for the Los Angeles Times.
Just ahead, enforcement works in preventing teenagers from buying cigarettes, but they're still smoking.
And later in the program, we take a trip to Coney Island.
There's more coming up here and now.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Gail Harris.
It's Here and Now.
Strict law enforcement may prevent retailers from selling cigarettes to minors, but has little or no impact on the numbers of teens who actually smoke. Now, that may sound surprising, but it is the conclusion of a randomized study published today in the journal Nicotine and Tobacco Research. The lead author of the study is Dr. Michael Cummings of the Roswell Park Cancer Institute in Buffalo, New York. Hello, Dr. Cummings. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
So you found that enforcing the laws against selling cigarettes to minors does work. How did you reach that conclusion?
Well, we checked the retailers to see if they were selling the cigarettes to kids. We sent minors into stores in 12 different communities, and the enforcement effort that was underway basically changed over time. We went from a very low enforcement level to a compliance level of retailers that in some communities reached over 90%.
And what was the impact on teen smoking? 90% sounds pretty impressive.
It does sound impressive, and we were hopeful that it would have a big effect on kids' smoking rates. We looked at ninth graders, and we thought that cracking down on the sales at retail levels might make it a little harder for them to get cigarettes. But what they told us, before we did the study, in 92 we had surveyed ninth graders in these communities, and 91% had told us it's very easy to get cigarettes, and when we went back in 1996 after the effort of enforcement, we found that 91% told us it's very easy to get cigarettes. It had virtually no effect on the smoking rates.
So if they weren't getting them from retailers, where were they getting them from? Friends, older brothers and sisters, who?
That's what they told us. We did see a shifting in where kids said they got their cigarettes from commercial sources more to social sources. In other words, their friends, their family members.
What conclusion do you draw from this? I mean, we have a lot of laws aimed at discouraging underage smoking. Does this tell you that these laws are a waste of time?
I think they're a waste of time and money, actually. You know, if the goal is to reduce adolescent smoking, this is not doing it. And I think we probably would be better directed at putting our emphasis on other strategies that are known to reduce adolescent smoking.
For example?
Raise the price of cigarettes. Won't cost anything. A lot of governments need a little extra tax revenue now, and one way to get that is just to raise the price. There's a very direct relationship we've seen. When you raise the price of cigarettes, consumption goes down, particularly in those who have less income and are a little bit more price sensitive, and that includes adolescents.
Well, it's an eye-opening study. Thank you so much for sharing it with us, Dr. Cummings.
Thank you.
Dr. Michael Cummings is at the Roswell Park Cancer Institute in Buffalo, New York.
Who doesn't often think that the world would be a better place if there was more empathy, if people were better at understanding and identifying with the feelings of others? But what is empathy exactly? Is it unique to humans? Is it learned, or are you born with it? Judy Foreman is Here and Now's regular health columnist. She joins us in the studio to talk about empathy. Hi, Judy.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine. I'm so sorry that you, trying to fill in the blank here, trying to be empathetic. Is that really, what is that what empathy is? Just being sorry?
Well, it can be happy, too. I mean, if you had great news and I felt your joy, that's empathy, too. It's essentially the capacity to feel what you think another person is feeling.
With them.
Naturally, it's more complicated than that, but that's basically it.
Right. You quote in your column someone who says, empathy is the unseen glue that holds civilization together.
Yeah, I think it's what makes us feel connected. It's what makes us feel fellow humans. It's what makes us look at TV and see a starving kid in Africa and say, that could be me, that could be my kid.
Right. So where does it come from?
Scientists think it basically comes from our inborn ability to mimic facial expressions. When a baby is born, within minutes to hours, the baby can imitate your facial expression. If you look at the baby and stick your tongue out, the baby can too and will in response to you. If you make a frown or a funny face, if the baby has the muscle power to do it, it will do it. And scientists think that that ability to kind of see an expression and mimic it is where empathy comes from, essentially the foundation for empathy.
Can animals empathize?
Well, that is a really interesting question. There's some really interesting research, not recent, but it's been proven over the years in chimpanzees that if there's a fight between two chimps, a third chimp will often come over and give a hug or a kiss to the chimp that lost the fight. Mm-hmm. Now, is that empathy? Is that compassion? Or is that just, you know, hey, you know, my adrenaline's too high and I want to feel better, so you calm down.
Right. Well, and is it learned or is it hardwired?
I think the ability to mimic is definitely hardwired. There's probably a lot of social learning involved in sort of translating that basic situation into empathy. There's been some interesting research at UCLA and some in France and other places where they have done brain scans on people looking at facial expressions of someone else. And if they just look, a certain area in the brain called the insula lights up somewhat. Mm. If they actually mimic the expression, that area lights up even more. Mm. So it suggests that the wiring is there to respond to another person's feelings.
Right. Well, all you have to do to gauge the importance of empathy is understand that there are people in our society who are unable to have it.
Yes, that's very true for people with autism. I mean, it's kind of characterized by social withdrawal and the inability to sort of see what other people are feeling. And, you know, also with psychopaths, people who murder and have no remorse and can't identify with their victim at all. Those are really, especially with autism, I mean, that's a clear brain disorder, and those people can't empathize. In fact, there's some thought that maybe you could help people with autism by trying to teach them empathy, by trying to teach them how to mimic a facial expression.
You also write that people have a personal stake in being empathetic.
Yes, in terms of kind of like evolution, parents who can empathize with their baby's pain or hunger or whatever are likely to take better care of that baby than someone who's ignoring all those signals. So ultimately, the offspring would do better. You know, nature has probably programmed us to take care of each other that way.
Right. It's a matter of survival.
That's right.
Well, Judy, thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
Judy Foreman, Here and Now's regular health commentator. To read her syndicated medical column, visit our website, here-now.org.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, the Archdiocese of Boston gets a new bishop. What will this mean to victims of abuse and others who say the Catholic Church has let them down?
And the Vatican reminds Catholic politicians, just say no to gay marriage. That's tomorrow.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. Here and Now.
funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, proudly supporting public radio and serving the community. On the web at MathWorks.com.
I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Coming up, President Bush is busy with matters Middle East today, a visit from Israel's prime minister and another with the Saudi foreign minister.
And we take a tour of historic Coney Island, home to many firsts, including the first enclosed amusement park, the first roller coaster, and the first hot dog sold at Feltman's Pavilion.
Feltman started off as someone who would sell bread to the various food concessions in the 1870s, Coney Island, when sausages and clams were the most popular food that people came to the beach to eat.
Nothing like a Coney Island dog. These stories coming up Here and Now.
I'm Dave Faniff. President Bush is hosting Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon at the White House today as he pushes for progress on the roadmap for peace. Sharon is coming armed with new concessions, the removal of some West Bank checkpoints, and release of more than 500 jailed Palestinian militants.
I wish to move forward with the political process with our Palestinian neighbors. And the right way to do that is only after a complete cessation of terror, violence, and incitement.
Sharon's visit comes 4 days after Palestinian Prime Minister Mahmoud Abbas met with President Bush. The Department of Homeland Security is warning that al-Qaeda may try new suicide hijackings similar to the 9/11 attack sometime over the next few months. An intelligence source says the warning is based on information received from at least one al-Qaeda prisoner, as well as intercepted communications. A longtime bodyguard of Saddam Hussein was captured this morning in Tikrit. U.S. troops say they also obtained documents that could help them in their search for the deposed Iraqi leader. Meantime, on Capitol Hill, the Pentagon's number two man won't predict how many troops will remain in Iraq or how much money a U.S. presence will cost. Deputy Defense Secretary Paul Wolfowitz was grilled today by Democratic Senator Joseph Biden.
You know it's going to be more than that. See, you know at least it's going to be $2.5 billion a month. Give me a break, will you? When are you guys starting to be honest with us? Come on. I mean, this
Senator,
is ridiculous.
To suggest
you're not even...
that this is an issue of honesty really is very
It is a suggestion
oh, it is, and
of
it is
candor,
very misleading.
Of candor.
Wolfowitz testified this morning before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. As California's first recall election inches closer, three separate lawsuits are challenging the way the state plans to carry it out. The recall law demands voters choose yes or no on whether to recall Davis before becoming eligible to choose a successor listed on the same ballot. Critics say that's unconstitutional. Meanwhile, an advisor to Arnold Schwarzenegger says the actor is leaning against a run for governor. Consumer confidence has taken a hit. The Conference Board says its July index declined nearly 7 points to 76.6. Analysts had been expecting a modest gain in July. On Wall Street this hour, stocks are down. The Dow is off nearly 16 points at 92.50.5. The Nasdaq is down 2.33 at 17.33. The S&P 500 down 1.33 at 995.19. This is Here and Now.
I'm Gail Harris in for Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
They were meeting for their eighth time at the White House, and this morning President Bush put greater pressure on Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon to take extra steps towards Bush's roadmap to peace.
In our discussions, I encouraged the Prime Minister to take further steps to improve the daily conditions faced by Palestinians. Israelis and Palestinians deserve the same chance to live normal lives, free from fear, free from hatred and violence, and free from harassment.
But Prime Minister Sharon vowed to continue building the fence that separates Israelis from Palestinians in the West Bank. And that isn't the only thing that separates the two sides. The release of Palestinian prisoners, as well as the dismantling of roadblocks and settlements, are also contentious issues. While Sharon's visit follows last week's by Palestinian Prime Minister Mahmoud Abbas, this week we get the Israeli perspective. On the line is Daniel Marone. He's congressional liaison at the Israeli embassy in Washington. And Mr. Marone, President Bush urged Israel to consider the consequences of its actions on the peace process. What's your interpretation of that?
Well, let me report to you that there was a terrific meeting now between Prime Minister Sharon and President Bush, and we saw them come out and speak to the media. And I think they're in full agreement on how we can and should move forward in fighting terrorism and going ahead with the peace process.
Are they really, though, sir? Because President Bush has expressed dismay at the physical wall that's being built in the West Bank. Is there any move to stop that building?
Yeah, Robin, I'd like to tell you about this. This is a security fence, a security barrier that we must put up. We are forced to put up to construct, to defend ourselves. In the last 2.5 years, 817 Israelis have been killed and 5,600 wounded because of terror attacks, terrorists coming into Israel and blowing themselves up. Now, no nation will be able to tolerate that. We just have no other option. Mm. Put up this defensive barrier between us and the Palestinians. We will do that, making the extreme effort to minimize any effect it might have on the Palestinian population.
So you're saying in some of these reports we're hearing that Mr. Sharon might stop the construction on parts of the fence, that this isn't true?
No, the fence is security fence is going to be continued. Now, in certain areas, this is something that can be looked at. How can we minimize any effect it has on the Palestinians?
Mm. Well, let's go to some of the other issues. The Palestinians are saying that the release of about 500 prisoners, more than Israel had said originally that they would release, the Palestinians are saying that that's inadequate. And they're saying the same thing about the dismantling of some roadblocks. Which, again, Israel, I know, has put that forth as a good faith measure. Your response to the Palestinian feeling that that's not enough?
Well, I'd like to look at the positive side of where we are now. Just to remember where we were just a few months ago. We weren't talking to each other. Now the Israeli Prime Minister with Prime Minister Abbas, they meet regularly. We meet with the Palestinians, and we're trying to find common ground, how to move forward. But the key to this is that the Palestinians must understand that they have to dismantle all the terror organizations, all the infrastructure for terror, full cessation of the terrorism, the violence, the incitement. Now, we want to go forward. We proved it 3 years ago when we were ready for peace. Now we want to go ahead with this peace, but we must have security for our people.
And so there has to be an absolute cessation of terror acts from the Palestinian side before it can go forward? And just a few seconds, sir. Hello?
Yes.
Yeah. In just a few seconds, if you could answer that.
Yes, we have. We are going ahead. There are a few gestures that we have done. I mean, the release of prisoners is something that we don't have to do according to the roadmap. Mm-hmm. We are doing that. We want to show goodwill on our side towards the Palestinians, and we are not going to free murderers, people who have killed our children. But we are going ahead and releasing those that we can release.
Right. So it doesn't call on the absolute cessation. Well, Daniel Marone, thank you very much.
Well, nice speaking to Robin.
Daniel Marone, congressional liaison at the Israeli embassy in Washington.
The White House said this morning that it will not declassify information contained in last week's congressional report on the September 11th attacks. That decision came just hours before a meeting between President Bush and the Saudi foreign minister. 28 pages left blank in the congressional report had reportedly suggested that people connected to the Saudi government gave money to the hijackers. Saudi officials, furious about those accusations, had been asking for those sections to be made public. Joining us on the line from New York City is Richard Murphy, former U.S. ambassador to Saudi Arabia and senior fellow for the Middle East for the Council on Foreign Relations. Mr. Ambassador, as you know, the White House said just this morning that despite the Saudis' request, it will not declassify this information. Why not, do you think?
Well, if the story is correct that the Saudis would like it declassified, then I'm very puzzled indeed. It suggests that the White House has other things it does not want revealed, which do not apply to Saudi Arabia.
Well, and as you know, the Saudi ambassador to the United States, Prince Bandar, said last week that the material was probably classified because it couldn't be substantiated. He said that Saudi Arabia has nothing to hide, that we can deal with questions in public but can't respond to blank pages.
The problem with having a section which has been so much talked about as containing very sensitive material, presumably, that can't be made available to the public, suggests that there's something incredibly or damaging to the Saudi Arabians. It may apply to another country. It may apply to our own administration. I don't know, and we won't know unless it is declassified.
Also, help us draw the distinction between some of this questionable activity which involved Saudi citizens, some of whom worked for the Saudi government. But that doesn't necessarily mean that the government was involved in supporting terrorism.
Well, that's correct. The broader question, has the royal family been directly sponsoring al-Qaeda in its attacks which led up to 9/11? And I think, obviously, the answer is no. With this proviso, that we realize there are some 7,000 male members of the royal family, equal number, presumably, of female members, and some of those may have wittingly supported al-Qaeda organization, feeling that they were doing the right thing according to their view of religion. But the government know that they were the target of al-Qaeda. They were attacked by Osama bin Laden as impious rulers who had to be overthrown. I've always seen 9/11 as a way, in the eyes of Osama bin Laden, as killing two birds with one stone.
Well, the Saudi Arabians would also say, listen, we've arrested more than 200 al-Qaeda suspects over the last 2 months, so we're doing what we can.
I think the complaint is that, and justifiably on our part, is that before 9/11, the cooperation was spotty. And after 9/11, when it was realized just how much in the trigger sites of al-Qaeda the royal family was, along with the United States, there has been a steadily developing cooperation.
Well, Mr. Ambassador, thank you so much, as always, for being with us.
Okay, my pleasure.
Still to come, we go to Coney Island, home to the cyclone, the steeplechase, so much more.
You're listening to Here and Now.
For many commercial mariners, the long, monotonous voyage across the sea ferrying crates of consumer goods is only sweetened by a stop on the mainland, which can mean a chance to visit a mall or play a round of basketball. But surely even the U.S. is going the way of scrimshaw and sea shanties because of post-9/11 homeland security restrictions. Joining us on the line from New York is Douglas Stevenson. He's director of the Center for Seafarers' Rights. And, Doug, tell us, is this because of new laws or are they tightening up already existing restrictions?
The restrictions are based on existing laws that are being more rigorously enforced.
Yeah. And they regard visas and shore passes, and I understand that many of the crewmen just aren't getting them or aren't even aware that they were supposed to get them.
Well, some of the problems have been that in the past, visas have been easily obtained through waivers. Now there are no more waivers to speak of, and most seafarers are not getting shore leave simply because they don't possess a visa.
Yeah. Well, many of us living on the coast are familiar with the Seamen's Centers and churches that you see, you know, along the shore in cities like Boston and in New Jersey. What do those centers usually provide these men?
They provide a real important respite from their shipboard life. I mean, many of these seafarers are working 10 months to a year without a break, without time to go home. In some cases, they never get off the ship. The chaplains provide a facility for them to go to, and in some cases, if they can't get off the ship, communication facilities to call home.
Right. We know that some chaplains are boarding the ships and bringing them cell phones and things because they can't
get
off. But in some ports, even the chaplains aren't allowed to board the ship. So, you know, some would say 9/11 changed everything, and there are seamen who jump ships. There are ships that carry stowaways, and, of course, a ship could be a great taxi service for a potential terrorist. So Why not tighten up?
Well, the problem is that seafarers have never been shown to be a risk. Generally, they like Americans, they like coming to America, and there's absolutely no intelligence or no evidence to link ships' crew members to security risks. And if we treat them as if they are terrorists themselves, they become disgruntled and they lose confidence in the system that's designed to protect them and our security of our ports.
Right. Before we let you go, how many people are we talking about that are affected by this?
It's hard to know how many people are affected by this. I mean, we've had reports that 60% of the vessels coming into a particular port have people denied shore leave.
What are you hearing from some of these mariners? I imagine, we've seen a picture and they can see the skyline, but they can't touch it.
Clearly, they're very disgruntled and very, very concerned. And the other part of the problem is that some of the security restrictions are being placed by private terminals, not by law enforcement officials. These are primarily oil terminals. So you have vessels that are trading between West Africa and the United States. They're not allowed to get off the ship in Africa because of security problems there. And when they come to the United States, the private terminal where their ship is docking won't let the seafarers off, even when they do have authorized shore leave from the Immigration Service.
Well, Doug, for the foreseeable future, they are pretty much stuck on that ship.
Well, there is some progress being made. Hopefully we can find a solution in better identification systems that will be acceptable in this country as a substitute for a visa.
Well, Doug, thank you.
Thank you.
Doug Stevenson is director of the Center for Seafarers' Rights. He spoke to us from New York.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Gail Harris.
It's Here and Now.
100 years ago, the huddled masses sailing toward New York Harbor gazed upon something truly amazing. Their first image of America was not Lady Liberty. It was not Ellis Island. It was Coney Island. Thousands of light bulbs illuminated the towers, minarets, and massive mechanical rides that occupied the small island just off the southern tip of Brooklyn. The glow was visible up to 30 miles out to sea. European architects, with their lavish old-world designs, had created a fantasy world unlike anything that existed on Earth. Disneyland, Six Flags, Busch Gardens, they're all spawned from the mother of all amusement centers. But according to historian Michael Immerso, Coney Island was much more than a thrill ride.
Prior to the 1870s, the idea of going to the beach and swimming was something that was not done by the average person. It was really something that rich people did at places like Newport, Rhode Island. And so what Coney Island did was introduce all American classes to leisure, to five-sense amusements, to the roller coasters and mechanical rides. It was the place where the average person had their day in the sun.
Michael Immerso is author of the new book, Coney Island, The People's Playground, where he explains that Coney Island was home to many firsts, including the first enclosed amusement park, Luna Park. This year, Luna Park is celebrating its 100th birthday. And according to author Immerso, Coney Island still plays a vital role in American culture.
The amusement area of Coney Island has shrunken considerably, but one aspect of Coney Island's significance that remains today and that's been constant for many, many generations is its role in terms of a place where immigrants
come and feel comfortable. It's not as expensive as contemporary amusement parks. It's not intimidating. Part of that appeal is that I think for new immigrants from South America, from the Caribbean area, South Asia, from places like Pakistan, Coney Island is a place that actually would resemble the kind of carnival that somebody living in a small village in one of these countries would have experienced, for example, on a special day or on a feast day in their town or in their village. It's that aspect of Coney Island that allows people to begin to participate in American popular culture. So it's a kind of point of entry for immigrants even today.
Last month, Coney Island held its fabulous Mermaid Parade, and producer Karen Palin caught up with Michael Immerso to soak up some history.
So you say the hot dog was invented at Coney Island. How is that?
The inventor actually was a fellow by the name of Feltman, who ran the famous Feltman's Pavilion on Surf Avenue for many, many years. Feltman started off as someone who would sell bread to the various food concessions in the 1870s at Coney Island, when sausages and clams were the most popular food that people came to the beach to eat. A friend of Feltman suggested to him that if he was to give out a piece of bread with the sausages, that people could take the bread, hold the sausage in it, and they would be able to eat it while they were walking on the beach. Well, two things have happened once this occurs. You've invented the hot dog, but essentially you've also invented fast food.
Well, you know what? On that note, I think I might want a hot dog. Are you hungry?
Sure.
Okay, let's go get a hot dog.
Hot dog, shish kebab, Italian sausage, French fries, onion rings.
We are standing at the corner of Surf Avenue and Stillwell Avenue, and this is Nathan's Hot Dog, famous Nathan. I've heard of Nathan's, actually. Tell me about him.
Okay. Jimmy Durante claims that he encountered Nathan Handwerker. They became friends, and he suggested to Nathan that since Feltman sold his hot dogs for 10 cents, Nathan could make a bundle by charging a nickel for a hot dog. So he opened up the first nickel hot dog shop at Coney Island. Nelson Rockefeller, when he ran for governor of New York, came out to be photographed eating a hot dog at Nathan's and was quoted as saying that you couldn't possibly get elected for any office in New York City or New York State if you weren't seen eating a hot dog at Nathan's, because it was so much a part and parcel of the public culture of New York City.
Anybody waiting for hot dog?
All right, so my Nathan's hot dog has a good amount of sauerkraut, relish, and mustard on it. Here goes. This is pretty good.
Practically speechless.
Yum.
Well, treats, yes indeed. Always winners, always prizes, each and every single time we go.
Now, we're just, maybe 100 feet behind the boardwalk, is that correct?
Yes.
And I see off in the distance, a little further east of us, is the Cyclone. Tell me a little bit about that, because I want to ride it later.
Okay. Well, the Cyclone was built in 1927, and so a year ago it had its 75th anniversary. It's considered by many roller coaster purists to be the greatest roller coaster ever built. There's other coasters which are certainly in size and in terms of their thrill factor surpass the Cyclone. But a lot of roller coaster enthusiasts feel that you really don't get the authentic experience of a coaster if it's not a wooden coaster, because you actually don't feel the same kind of movement. You don't have the same kind of experience. Now, some years ago, there was talk of tearing down the Cyclone, and a Save the Cyclone campaign was organized all across the United States. They prevented it from being torn down, and so obviously still operating today and still thrilling riders.
Screwdrivers, 6-inch wooden rope that hammers the victim into the center of his head, yet he lives to laugh and joke about it. How does he do it, folks? Why does he do it? You've got to see it with your own eyes to believe it. You're going to see Madame Twistow, the elastic lady, our beautiful and talented contortionist girl. She's a
So we're on Surf Avenue?
When you're on Surf Avenue, and the Mermaid Parade has just started, it was led by a rather portly King Neptune and a rather attractive group of mermaid consorts, one of them with an extremely attractive blue bouffant hairdo that seemed to be about 18 inches high. The whole idea of the parade is to have costumes and floats, all of which reflect either a mermaid theme or another theme having to do with the sea or the ocean. We have a marching band which seems to involve some kind of exotic extraterrestrial seahorses, as best I can make out.
Well, I'm seeing some nudity.
Yeah, you'll see more of that. Where we're standing, actually, is opposite the site on Surf Avenue of Coney Island's famous Luna Park. Luna Park is arguably the greatest and most influential amusement park ever created. And it opened here in Coney Island exactly 100 years ago, this past May 16th. It was conceived by a man by the name of Fred Thompson, whose idea was to try to create an amusement park that really embodied everyone's childhood fantasies. And he took as his model the sort of imaginary Baghdad of the Arabian Nights. When you walked through the gates of Luna Park, you could enter a building where you could travel to the moon in an airship. You could travel to the North Pole in a submarine. You could have taken a ride on a canal in a miniature Venice. There were circus acts. There were native villages of exotic people from all around the world. And so the evening of May 16th, there were thousands of people on Surf Avenue when exactly at 8 o'clock p.m., Luna Park's 100,000 or so lights were turned on, and people actually just froze in their spots. They gasped, they rubbed their eyes. No one had ever seen anything like Luna Park before. In its first couple of years, it would regularly draw something like 5 million people each season. Luna Park burned to the ground in 1944. But during its existence, it really was the prototype for practically every amusement park that came afterwards.
Michael Immerso is an historian and author of the new book, Coney Island, The People's Playground. For more information on Coney Island and some pictures of producer Karen Pellin's tour, you can visit our website, here-now.org. Oh, and Karen did finally get to ride the Cyclone. Karen. Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Robin Young.
Get into your radio.
And join us again. Here and Now.
Darkness for some light. Time's a waste. Yeah, she says. Summer nights. The edge of the city. Saying, darling, think of me. So we lay.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software. Information on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Robin Young.
Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. Time for the news and these stories here and now.